Morning, are council ready?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. My name is Jeff Clark, and I represent the Delaware State Housing Authority. Just as some brief background, this action involves 26 Clark's Corner, which is a rental unit in Clark's Corner in Harrington, Delaware, that is a public housing authority site owned and operated by the Delaware State Housing Authority. The matter before the court on appeal today involves the Superior Court's decision pursuant to a petition for writ of certiorari. In this case, multiple Supreme Court decisions have indicated that pursuant to that extraordinary writ, that reviews for the sufficiency of the evidence should not be undertaken. In this matter, most germanely, the Superior Court, in its November order, phrased the sole issue before the court as, and I quote, "The limited question before this court is whether the outcome announced by the Justice of the Peace Court has or does not have as its basis sufficient fact to support its decision."
But do you agree that the Superior Court could review and grant relief if there was no evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that's a distinction that I don't believe that that would be a correct distinction, Your Honor, and the reason being, in order to review for no evidence or a scintilla of the evidence, you would the Superior Court would have to review for the sufficiency of the evidence. I believe that that is one and the same thing.
Well, if the Superior Court found that on the face of the Justice of the Peace opinion that there was a failure of proof as to one element, which arguably happened here, wouldn't that be cognizable on certiorari?
You're right. Based on the opinion itself, if there was legal error evidenced on in the Justice of the Peace Court decision itself, yes, that would be reviewable pursuant to a petition for writ of certiorari.
Okay. And if I understand the position that's being taken here by your honorable adversary, the Superior Court concluded that in order to uphold the eviction, there had to be evidence that the conduct actually threatened safety and the peaceable use of the premises by the tenants, and there was no such evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that is their position, and that it's certainly the Housing Authority's position that was an error. The Justice of the Peace Court decision first in February 2007.
Well, before you get
yes,
to that, Mr. Clark, so do we really have an issue of whether cert was the proper vehicle, or are we past that and really into whether the court properly, that is, validly found that there was a failure of proof on one element?
I believe that the threshold issue here is whether certiorari was proper. And the reason being that, you know, the Justice of the Peace Court is directed pursuant to a summary possession action to go through a quick proceeding and has a unique appeal mechanism where it has two de novo trials. In this case, really at the outset, in the February 20th, 2007 order by the Justice of the Peace Court, they issued a four-page decision going through what the facts were, and they held, after reviewing all the testimony and evidence, the court enters the following order, and they found that the defendant violated Section 8M of the rental contract by engaging in any criminal activity that threatens the health, safety, or right to peaceful enjoyment of the residents residing at Clark's Corner. That is a correct standard. The Superior Court, when it reviewed and remanded the matter, agreed that was the correct standard. When the Justice of the Peace Court issued its remand decision, it again found that same and went through the facts that justified that. So based on, you know, a petition for a writ of certiorari, when the Justice of the Peace Court goes through and finds these facts and applies the correct legal standard as it did in this case and made a finding as to all the necessary elements in federal law that provide this legal standard, that should be the end of the analysis. Now, really to launch into what, Justice Jacobs, what you were asking with regard to the evidence in this case.
Well, before we get to that, what is the issue on this threshold jurisdictional question? I'm not sure what it is you're asking us to decide.
Yeah.
It appears, and tell me where I'm off base here, that this was properly brought as a cert case, that it did not really involve a weighing of the evidence in the sense that the trial judge was, considering the evidence by Ms. Howell and the evidence by the authority and the deciding which was the more persuasive. Basically, what the trial judge did was to say there was additional evidence that needed to be put into the record, and it wasn't, and therefore there was a failure of proof, which is a merits issue.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I think that's correct. But again, with the various decisions by the Supreme Court indicating that it's supposed to be reviewed based on the face of the record, it's the appellant's position that in a summary possession proceeding in this unique mechanism, that if the Justice of the Peace Court goes through and indicates in its order that it's decided something to the correct legal standard, that should be where the analysis stops in that regard.
That's a conclusion, but if there's, that was a conclusion. You're saying if the Justice of the Peace Court, enters a one-line or one-paragraph opinion just stating summarily and conclusorily that there's been a violation of whatever the appropriate section was, that can't be reviewed on certiorari?
Your Honor, if that would be the appellant's position in the first instance, yes, sir. And that the reason being, again, the face of the record in that case constitutes the order. What happens is, you have a summary possession proceeding that the Supreme Court has indicated, for instance, in the Bama case, expresses and evidences an express intent by the legislature to keep, and this is the court's words, to keep the Superior Court out of Justice of the Peace Court matter.
So when the Superior Court remanded the first time, directing the Justice of the Peace Court to make more explicit findings, it had no authority under a writ of certiorari to do that?
Your Honor, I would word it that it was an error of law in that instance to do it under the circumstances of this case with an order on the record that laid out the proper standard, laid out a recitation of the evidence, and indicated that they considered that. But then, Your Honor, really to go back to the heart and the focus of perhaps the most imminent position that DSHA has, the November 2007 order, which examined the remand order by the Justice of the Peace Court. The Justice of the Peace Court in that case wrote an excellent, well-justified decision. It talked about, made a couple factual findings, including, of course, that there was criminal activity, which really wasn't, I don't believe, disputed.
Before you get into the details, what is the error, that is, in turning to the merits argument, that is, did the Superior Court err by holding that there was an additional element that needed to be proved that additional element as a matter of law was not required? Well, that is, did he engraft an additional element that was legally insupportable?
No,
or
Your Honor.
Did he not do that?
No, Your Honor, really all three decisions that are before the court, the original February 07 JP order, the Superior Court's remand order, and the Justice of the Peace Court September order all articulated the correct standard. The Superior Court correctly articulated the standard in this case.
Okay, then what you're arguing, I gather, is that the court simply erred in finding factually that there was no proof of a threat.
Yes, Your Honor, that's our alternative argument. The first argument was sifting through the record was error to do so. And actually, looking at the facts that were presented, that was clear error as well. Your Honor, we would argue that you really would need to distinguish a petition for writ of certiorari, an extraordinary writ, from, for instance, an appeal of an industrial accident board decision, where the court is requested or required by statute to go through and do a substantial evidence review and by the common law. In this, in order to review evidence for, in order to see if there's any evidence out there, you have to review for sufficiency of the evidence.
Can I turn for a minute to the substantive issue here? If I'm correct, the lease provides for eviction in the event that someone engages in criminal activity that threatens the health, safety, or right to peaceful enjoyment of other residents, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the trial court, if I'm correct, said that in order to satisfy that requirement, there must be evidence of an actual threat to someone who is a tenant there, and that in this case there was an altercation, it was criminal activity, but none of the participants in that criminal activity were threatening another tenant, and therefore there was no basis for an eviction, right?
I believe that was a correct summation of the Superior Court's decision pursuant to the writ of certiorari, yes, Your Honor.
And you agree with that as a matter of interpretation of the meaning of the eviction clause?
Yes, Your Honor. That lease provision is expressly set out in federal statute that this public housing authority, in receipt of these federal funds, has to apply that standard, which is a shall be cause for termination of tenancy standard.
No, that's not what I'm asking. Okay. It seems to me, apparently I'm the only one who has this concern, but it seems to me that the criminal activity doesn't have to be criminal activity directed at a tenant. If there's criminal activity that threatens the health, safety, or right to peaceful enjoyment of the tenants, that would be a basis for evicting someone.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the trial court, if I understand correctly, added another requirement and said that the threat has to be a threat directly to another tenant. It can't just be, I'm a tenant, I'm sitting here, and my right to peacefully enjoy my apartment is being violated by the fact that there's a shootout going on my front porch. Nobody is trying to shoot me, but there is a shootout. And you're saying the housing authority has no ability to evict the person involved in the shootout because they weren't trying to shoot me?
No, Your Honor, we would agree that they have the ability to evict in that case. And what really the Superior Court's decision in this matter focused on a requirement that it causes an adverse impact. And the federal standard and the lease standard, as Your Honor points out, is threats to cause. And the record in this case, and really going to that point, Your Honor, the record in this case is replete with facts where, this is a fight that happened in an apartment unit that lasted 15 to 20 minutes. There was loud cursing, yelling. Both combatants were injured.
Is it your position that the other occupants of the apartment are tenants within the meaning of this provision?
No, Your Honor. I believe the correct definition of tenant for purposes of this analysis is people with a right of occupancy of living there. And they include the children, for instance, of Ms. Howe.
Well, that's what I was focusing on. So the children are tenants, and if there's endangering the welfare of a child within an individual apartment, that's the basis, that can be a basis to evict in and of itself.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position. And in addition to that, there's actually evidence of record that at least three of Ms. Howe's children came downstairs while the altercation was going on. And while that altercation was going on, and didn't end until two Harrington police officers came in with tasers and threatened them and stopped them. After that point in time, of course, resisting arrest happened. So,
well, here's the problem, and I'm obviously just confused here, but the JP court agreed with you and said that this person needs to be evicted, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And the trial court reversed and said, no, the facts here don't support an eviction, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if I understood you, you were saying we're only appealing the fact that the trial court looked at the facts. But if we get to the underlying substance of it, we agree with the trial court that there, you know, there wasn't a basis to evict.
Yeah, no, Your Honor, that is not the Housing Authority's position at all. Really, that's the second argument, and really that which was argument two in both of our opening brief and our reply brief, focuses on the fact that the Justice of the Peace Court, as a fact finder, is permitted to make inferences with regards to the facts. The Housing Authority goes through those facts, lays out how the facts in this case provide a reasonable inference that the other tenants.
You're into your rebuttal time. I don't want to take too much of it, but am I correct then in saying that you are contending the trial court erred in two respects?
That's correct.
First, in terms of not applying the proper legal standard on a writ of certiorari, and second, if you get to the question of what the underlying facts were as presented to the Justice of the Peace Court and as found by the Justice of the Peace Court, that the trial court erred in saying that those facts were insufficient to support an eviction.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And thank Your Honor, if I'll sit down if I may be excused.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James D. McGiffin, Jr. from the Community Legal Aid Society on behalf of Lucille Howe. Your Honors, if I may, let me direct my first comment to a question that Justice Berger asked about the Superior Court's decision with respect to a direct threat to another tenant. I respectfully read the Superior Court's decision a little bit differently. I understand the Superior Court to have said that there has to be a threat to a tenant and it has to have a negative effect on the tenant, but not that it has to be a direct threat to the tenant. So,
okay, but let me stop you there because I get confused easily. We've got an altercation that involves people getting bloodied up, right?
Yes.
And it's not an instantaneous thing. It's an ongoing for 15 minutes or so altercation.
Yes.
And you're saying that without direct evidence that somebody else felt threatened by what was going on, you can't evict the person?
Yes, yes.
So you can't say, you can't have a record that establishes a bloody altercation, which means potentially serious injuries and presumably people who are out of control, other people who are in the vicinity where this altercation is going on, and you can't make an inference as a result of those two facts that those other people were at least their sense of health and well-being, whatever the general peaceful existence, that wasn't threatened?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what I'm saying. And I'm saying that because primarily because the distinction that's made in the regulations, both for drug activity versus non-drug activity, where for drug-related activity, Congress actually made that inference. Congress said that if there is drug-related activity, we will infer that other tenants are threatened, and therefore you don't have to prove that. So for drug-related activity, that's not an element of the proof. And the same is true for public housing versus Section 8. Now, Section 8 voucher particularly, the Section 8 voucher program is a program where a tenant gets a voucher, goes out into the market, rents a place that can be anywhere. And again, Congress determined not to require the threat to other people.
Let's illustrate that with a hypothetical.
Certainly.
Under your reading of this language, a tenant who takes a needle and drugs and injects controlled substances could be evicted for ejecting them into himself or herself.
Absolutely.
If that tenant injects controlled substances or poison into another occupant of that apartment and kills them, could not be evicted.
I still think the controlled substances would allow for an eviction, but a poison,
all right, let's
being
say,
not a drug-related activity.
Let's say it's air.
Air, fine. The tenant certainly could be evicted if as soon as any other tenant became aware of that, they reported it to management, and management acted. The evidence the state didn't have to bring in a tenant to say, I was aware of that fight and it frightened me. That's not what I'm saying.
All right. What are you saying? What did the state have to do in with respect to that particular element?
It had to present the slightest amount of evidence that anybody else there who was a resident was even conscious of this activity.
Well, what about the children?
Well, the children are tenants by virtue of Lucille Howell's tenancy. So it doesn't make sense to me that the regulation could be read to allow the children to be evicted because they were threatened by something that took place in the unit. Secondly, the record doesn't demonstrate that the children were conscious of this. Mr. Clark just said that three of Lucille's house children were downstairs, but the transcript doesn't indicate that. The transcript only indicates from the report of Roger, who was not another resident, he was the guest's son, he said that his other cousin and the two little ones came down. Now, the record also indicates there were eight children there. So we don't know. The guest brought four, and four were Ms. Howell's. And so we know that there were a total of four children downstairs at some point during the fight or at the conclusion of the fight, but we don't know who those children were except other cousin and two little ones. So we don't know that Lucille Howell's children were ever conscious of this. There's no fact to suggest that they were. So I think for both of those reasons, the state is wrong to rely on the presence of the children in the unit as satisfying the other residents' prong of the other residents'
there
element.
Was evidence wasn't there that the child, at least a child, witnessed the altercation.
Absolutely, and that child was the 14-year-old son of the guest, not a resident of Clark's Corner. There's no evidence that Carla Ennals or any of her children were residents of Clark's Corner. And it has to be another resident of that housing project to qualify as one of the elements, to qualify as part of this threat element. The threat has to be to the health, safety, or right of peaceful enjoyment of other residents. So there are several requirements there. I think... I wanted to speak to the issue of certiorari and whether and
excuse me, Mr. McGiffin.
Yes.
Before you get to that, I gather that the argument you're making is not unlike the tree falling down in the forest. If nobody's there to hear it hit the ground, then it didn't happen. So that is to say, let's assume the same facts here. The two women are blooding each other up. They're hitting each other over the head with telephones. They're in just a god-awful fight. But all the doors and windows are sealed shut and nobody hears or witnesses it. Under those circumstances, no eviction.
Given no other facts, I would agree, no eviction. That's a distinction that Congress made when it instituted that additional element of a requirement that there be a threat to other residents.
But there would be an eviction if someone, that is, if, say, Mrs. Howell told another resident what happened in that resident. And,
if that resident then became concerned or felt a threat and reported that threat to management, absolutely, Your Honor.
So then this case turns on the fortuity of the housing authority being the party to initiate the complaint and not another resident.
Unless, of course, it's true that no other resident ever became conscious of the fight, which I think is completely consistent with the evidence.
Well, isn't your position, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there has to be an actual causation of the loss of health, safety, or right to peaceful enjoyment by another tenant as opposed to a threat or a risk that would be that result?
Your Honor, if you forgive me, I'm not sure I can make a distinction between a threat and awareness of risk. I'm not sure that there is a distinction between that. I think if I become aware of a risk to me, I can feel threatened. And I think if a tenant in the next-door apartment became aware that there was a risk as a result of Ms. Howell's behavior and she reported that or somehow management became aware of that, then that would be enough. It's a really small element, but it is an essential element. We don't need a huge quantum of proof. We just need something that says, something that shows, that demonstrates that somebody at Clark's Corner was aware that this was going on and was concerned. And what we have here is absolutely nothing to that effect.
But that assumes then that there must be an actual causation of that concern as opposed to a threat of that concern coming into being.
Again, if you forgive me, Your Honor, that's a distinction that I'm having trouble making in my own mind. I'm afraid I can't really.
Well, you're making it, though, aren't you?
Because, am I?
Well, let's take two different hypotheticals. Under the ruling of the court, there had to be additional evidence by somebody.
Yes.
And if the ruling of the court was that there had to be proof of actual causation, that meant that another resident would have to get on the witness stand and testify that, I witnessed this fight and I was terrified, and I was terrified for my children. In other words, that caused me to be terrified. That's case one.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Second case, same witness gets up and says, well, I wasn't there to witness it, but I became conscious of it later because I could hear the shouting and screaming outside. No testimony about whether it caused that witness to be frightened or upset or anything else. Now, under your view of what the court held, which hypothetical represents the required level of proof?
I believe either.
Okay, so what you're saying is that there doesn't have to be independent evidence of illegal activity or the challenged activity actually caused a threat to the peaceful enjoyment or safety, but only that somebody be aware that the activity had taken place.
I believe that the Superior Court found that the former were to be true, that there actually had to be a cause. If I read the Superior Court's decision correctly, when I read
agreeing with Justice Ridgely's question then. That is, the Superior Court required that there had to be independent proof that the offensive activity caused a threat or
I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question. The word that the Superior Court uses is nexus, and I think that's what that means. I believe when I in reading the other cases in other jurisdictions that address this, it seems to me pretty clear that there just has to be evidence that there that other folks were aware of it, and the court is allowed to make the leap that their awareness is enough for a threat. But
all
I don't.
All right. Again, I'm sorry that we're all giving you hypotheticals here, but I think we're all trying to find out how this is supposed to operate, at least in your view. If there's some kind of an altercation on the front steps and other people who were tenants in the building were walking by, can we conclude that there was a basis for eviction without actually calling one of those other tenants as witnesses or getting their affidavit or some other way putting evidence in as to what their reaction was to seeing a pretty violent fist fight going on?
I think it's fair to say that the regulation would allow any admissible evidence that other residents were aware of this and reacted to it would be sufficient. I don't think we have to have the actual tenants in.
So in other words, if there were evidence that other people were around when this happened, that would suffice, and none of those other people would have to actually be witnesses.
Provided those other people were residents, as that's one
right.
of the criteria, I think the regulation can be read that way.
And don't we have that here in the sense that we have evidence that children who were tenants were there when this fist fight was going on?
Well, the only evidence we have is that they were upstairs asleep. That's the only when we read the transcript, that's the only evidence that we have about the Howell children.
Upstairs asleep or just upstairs?
The transcript indicates upstairs asleep. There may be my best recollection of the transcript indicates that the reference to the other children is that they were upstairs asleep, and then there was a subsequent reference that three children, I'm sorry, Roger, the 14-year-old, was always downstairs. He was the guest son. He was always downstairs. The other seven children were upstairs asleep. Three of those children came downstairs. We don't know who they are.
Okay, and they were downstairs when the police arrived and
yes.
the threat to break it up or we're going to taser you right now, those kind of comments were made. So that doesn't that suggest the fighting was ongoing in those children's presence?
It may. And were those children the Howell children? Then, and were this court willing to say that the regulation means that the Howell children could be made homeless because they've witnessed a fight, then I think we'd be done. But the evidence doesn't indicate that it was the Howell children, and I'm not willing to concede that this regulation allowed, when it references other residents, it means children of the tenant, children who are in that unit by virtue of the tenancy of Ms. Howell, of the principal of the activity.
Now, the lease terms specifically exempt and have special categories for domestic violence victims, right?
Yes, they do. Particularly under the new VAWA statute, there is a new regulatory imposition on housing authorities for victims of domestic violence.
I take it that came about because domestic violence victims were losing their apartments?
Yes, that's absolutely true.
So they're, but is endangering the welfare of a child in that same category or not?
Is endangering the welfare of a child domestic violence? Certainly it is. Certainly under this, the Title 10 definition in Section 1041, et cetera, the Protection from Abuse statute, which is our civil domestic violence statute, endangering the welfare of a children falls within the eight definitions of abuse, which is what I believe VAWA references when it references domestic violence. It references the state's definition of abuse. And our statute includes activity which threatens or causes physical injury or reasonable apprehension of physical injury. And so, in a sense, the domestic violence statute also incorporates a threatened language. And I believe that endangering the welfare of the children, that crime, the activities that equal that crime, easily fit within the definition of abuse.
Now, the resisting arrest was in the hallway, wasn't it?
It was actually outside the unit. It wasn't a hallway. It was outdoors.
But on the premises?
On the premises, yes.
And observable by other people who lived there?
Had there been anybody there observing, absolutely. But, again, there was absolutely no evidence that anyone observed this.
Is the nature of this public housing unit a description of it in the record? I mean, how many?
It is not. We don't know from this record whether it's a standalone unit or whether it's part of townhouses or whether it's a high-rise apartment. We don't know any of that because it's not in the record.
I probably have this wrong here, but I'm looking at something that suggests that Howell resisted arrest outside of her apartment in front of two other children living in the building. Is that not accurate?
It's not my recollection, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I understand your position correctly, and I'm just asking you to clarify it, you seem to be arguing that in requiring that there be independent evidence of actual causation, that is, that the offensive behavior caused the threat, that the court went too far and erred. Nonetheless, it was not reversible error because, at the very least, as you argued, there had to be independent proof that someone, that is, some resident other than those who were engaging in the offensive behavior, was conscious that behavior was taking place.
And
that wasn't in the record.
I wouldn't say that the court erred. What I would say is that, given the variety of opinions in other jurisdictions, that there are two different ways to approach that. I happen to think that the court was dead on in that, But I also don't presume that I don't presume that everybody would agree with that. And certainly, other jurisdictions, the courts have.
So there are two lines of cases: some requiring proof of actual causation, and others requiring only proof that there was an outsider who was resident was conscious of the offense.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor.
So which of these lines of authority should we be adopting?
I certainly think that the direct threat makes a lot more sense. I think the regulatory framework establishes that we treat other criminal activity different than drug activity, and I just don't think we want the state that far into these units. The state's pretty far into those units now, and I think residents there should have some reasonable expectation that they can live their lives and without that level of intrusiveness.
Can I focus you on the decision of the Justice of the Peace Court, which says that Roji, the son of Ms. Annales, testified where he was, who started the fight, yada, yada, and then says he also testified that six of the remaining children came downstairs and viewed at least a portion of the fight. Doesn't that deal with the question of whether there were any tenants who were witnesses to this?
Your Honor, I should mention that my time is up. I'd be happy to answer the question.
Please do.
The Justice of the Peace Court made that conclusion. That conclusion cannot be derived from the record, from the transcript. The Justice of Peace Court made a number of conclusions that cannot be derived from the transcript. They simply misheard a lot of the evidence. They, for instance, said that the Harrington police officer testified that he threatened to use a taser. He never made that statement. That statement came elsewhere. I just think that the Justice of Peace Court read that evidence wrong, and it's just not there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor,
do you have any helpful information about the record here?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And just really with regard to the verbatim transcript B143, that's testimony by Raja Cannon, the minor witness that witnessed this, indicating, of course, testimony previously indicated that Lucille Howe is his cousin. Raja Cannon's testimony, my other cousin and the two little ones came down during the fight. That's direct evidence that they were there during the fight. And then, of course, it went on, and when did they stop fighting? When the cops came. And again, there's testimony that there were tasers being threatened. Of course, the Harrington officer, I don't recall whether he said that the tasers were present, but both of the combatants testified that they only broke this fight up when they were threatened with tasers. The other issue, and it goes to one of Justice Ridgely's questions, to be very clear, the statute at issue is 42 U.S.C. section 1437D, which does not have that domestic violence provision. The statute that does have the domestic violence provision that Your Honor referred to was the one erroneously referred to by the Superior Court in its order, which was 42 U.S.C. 1437F, which applies to Section 8 housing as opposed to public housing. And there are two different sets of rules, two different approaches. So
help me understand. What's the difference between public housing and Section 8 housing?
Just funding mechanisms, Your Honor, and for Congress has gone through and actually passed different statutes. The HUD has actually gone through and made different regulations apply to the two. Section 8 has different funding mechanisms where private landlords are able to go ahead and get subsidies from the federal government to rent their private properties out. The public housing authorities are subdivisions of the states or agencies of the states that run it. One other thing, Your Honor, and the court has spent a lot of time focusing on the children, but again, this is a threat to the peaceful enjoyment. The JP court expressly found a threat to the peaceful enjoyment of other residents as well. And
based upon what?
Based upon inferences from the fact that this was a late night fight in an apartment where there was screaming and yelling, where two police came up, Your Honor, and came into the unit, where it went outside. Ms. Howe, direct testimony, continued to be disorderly outside, resisted arrest outside.
Is there any evidence that other people who were tenants were out there when the resisting arrest took place?
No, Your Honor, and that would be direct evidence of a threat. But as a Superior Court jury instruction provides, our system does not differentiate between the weight and value of direct versus circumstantial evidence. But
basically you're saying, with respect to this kind of thing, that we have to assume that since there was noise and police arrived and this is an apartment building, there must have been other tenants who were aware of what was going on and who felt uncomfortable about it.
Your Honor, the federal regulation, the standard is a threat to. So therefore, they would not have to be aware. They would have a threat that their peaceful enjoyment would be compromised.
Okay.
That's
the
federal
standard. Again, I need to be clear on this. Is it your position that if an altercation like this takes place, it does not matter whether it's the middle of the night and it just so happens that everybody else in the building is out at some party? If the wrongdoing, if the criminal activity takes place, that in and of itself is enough to evict the tenant because that creates a threat to the safe enjoyment of other tenants, whether they're there or not, whether they're aware of it or not, regardless.
Not in all circumstances, Your Honor, but yes, in circumstances whereas in this case, under the totality of the circumstances, taking into account the time, the location, different factors of the police response, if it provides a reasonable inference that it's been threatened or affected.
I would like to ask just one last question. Does the record reflect the nature of this apartment building?
No, Your Honor. It reflects that it is an apartment. It reflects that it is two floors, and that's the extent of what the record reflects.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and take a recess.
Right.